This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
This week, it's all about new science that matters. A study funded by a founder of fracking finds the natural gas industry is still bleeding tons of methane into the atmosphere. The top body for American scientists warns we must act now to prevent climate catastrophe. And an international team confirms the world food supply will be hit hard in a changing climate. I'm Alex. Welcome to Radio EcoShock. First, to our continuing coverage of methane emissions from natural gas. What could be more timely after a deadly blast in New York City and a barrage of ads from the industry saying how green they are? Please notice, I take care in the first story to let you know who funded this assessment of the industry and some of the energy-friendly government labs who took part in it. Even so, they found a lot of leaking methane and super emitters in some states. Surprise, surprise, a new study finds methane emissions from natural gas systems have been greatly underestimated. Methane is a potent greenhouse gas, as you know. Is gas worth the risk? Is it better than coal? Let's find out from the lead author of a brand new study looking at methane escaping from the gas system. Dr. Adam R. Brandt is with the Department of Energy Resources Engineering at Stanford University. Dr. Brandt, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thanks. Glad to be here.
Well, one of the first things I want to know is what led you to undertake this study of natural gas in America in the first place?
Sure. This study was commissioned by the Cynthia and George Mitchell Foundation. George Mitchell was one of the pioneering developers of hydraulic fracturing, and he had a long-term interest in ensuring that the gas industry, to the extent possible, reduced its environmental impacts and basically was as environmentally beneficial as possible. So his family foundation, he recently passed away, has focused on natural gas environmental impacts and trying to reduce these impacts. There's been a lot of studies recently that show really mixed evidence. Some studies report higher emissions, some studies report lower emissions, and so there's been a fair amount of confusion in the literature in recent years about what the real impacts of natural gas are. So the Mitchell Foundation sponsored this study to basically convene a group of experts from around the country. We had about 15 experts, and we looked at the existing evidence. So we tried to say, given all the studies that have been published in the last 20 years, let's review all of them, and what can we say on balance do we know about leakage from the natural gas system?
Yes, you had a huge team behind you with many names I recognize from the universities, NOAA and the Lawrence Livermore Lab, even the U.S. Department of State. So, Adam, a couple of years ago, we had Robert Howarth of Cornell on this program. He was among the first to try and figure this out. Why don't we start right at the fracking wellhead? Howarth said, and we have the video, the industry vents a lot of methane for a couple of weeks before attaching the well to the pipes or to the trucks. Did you start right at the wellhead?
Yeah, so our study goes from the wellhead all the way to the use in your homes for your water heaters or home heaters. So we look at the entire quote-unquote life cycle of the natural gas industry. We do look at hydraulic fracturing. It actually appears, we find overall, our overall result is that it appears that EPA is underestimating methane emissions by something like 50% relative to what we observe in the atmosphere at the largest scales. And we look specifically at natural gas and find that we think that the evidence suggests that natural gas emissions are underpredicted as well. With respect to fracking, we find that fracking is not likely to contribute a major portion of this excess emissions load. What we find is that fracking may contribute to the extent that producers, when they're hydraulically fracturing, are venting the gas rather than capturing the gas that flows back. Hydraulic fracturing may contribute. But even if you take a worst-case scenario for emissions from hydraulic fracturing using an accepted methodology from the literature for estimating these, it does not look like hydraulic fracturing is the key determinant of this. This looks like this is a problem with the gas industry as a whole. There's some interesting studies from the late 1990s and early 2000s, and this was well before fracking became a major technology being applied at scale, and those studies also found higher emissions when hydraulic fracturing was not prevalent. And so there's a variety of pieces of evidence that suggest to us that this is an issue with the gas industry more broadly not just hydraulic fracturing, although hydraulic fracturing may contribute.
Well, that's quite interesting because we've covered fracking quite a bit. Now, I want to follow this sort of step by step. Before we even get to the cities, we also have some leaky pipelines and some storage systems that have to vent anyway. What did you find out about that part of the natural gas pipeline system?
Yeah, so there's a variety of pieces of evidence. So after the gas is, the well is drilled and the gas is produced from the ground, there's a variety of processing stages that occur. There's compression to basically build up pressure in the gas for long-distance transport, and then there's transport in the these large-diameter pipelines that will take the gas across the country. And this is all before it ever gets to, you know, a city where it's going to be used. It appears, and there's a variety of studies, it appears that leakage from gas processing plants and gas compressors are consistently underestimated. So when people go to study these sources, these come out higher than EPA estimates. And so these have been found in a variety of studies. The most recent was a couple months ago. The earliest was probably in 2002 or so. And there's been a variety of studies of these stages of the gas process, and they do find higher emissions.
Okay, well now, getting to the cities, on Radio EcoShock, we just had Dr. Nathan Phillips from Boston U describing his study of leaks in Boston and in Washington, D.C. Were you able to zoom out from that to estimate the leakage in all American cities or anything along those lines?
This is a real challenge. So the Phillips studies are very interesting out of first Boston and now recently Washington, D.C. There was also another study out of Los Angeles that we actually used to calibrate this. One of the challenges of the Phillips studies, especially the Boston study, is that they were able to find areas of the city where there was a lot of methane, but they had a real challenge in trying to take those local concentrations and say how much is leaking overall. There was a nice study out of Los Angeles, out of Caltech, where they flew airplanes all around the city, and they estimated that something like 3 to 4% of the gas was leaking from the distribution system and from our homes. And so we used that to essentially that study to calibrate what the emissions from the distribution system overall might be. And if that's at all prevalent, then this could be a major source. This could be a big contributor to this gap, is basically lots of leaking pipes around our homes and businesses and cities. There's about 2 to 2.5 million miles of small diameter pipe, mostly underneath our roads, homes and businesses around the country. So this is, you know, literally millions of miles of pipe with lots of joints that can be leaking, et cetera, et cetera. So it's a really big and complex system, and this could be a significant contributor according to an increasing amount of evidence.
Yes, 3 or 4%, that's a big loss when we look at it over the whole of America. Well, Adam Brandt, you talk about methane super emitters. What and where are those?
This is a very important point. So one of the things that we found from a variety of studies is that it looks like when you actually go out and you measure all the sources at a given, let's say, all the well pads in a given area or all the valves and flanges at a facility, most of the sources are not major emitters. So 98, 99% of sources are not going to be emitting, and it's really 1 or 2% that have this problem. Among that 1 or 2%, there's often a fraction of a percent, like 0.01%, that are just broken. A valve is stuck open. There's a crack or a hole in a pipe. There's been instances where people have found rusty pipes that are essentially corroded with holes in them, and the gas is essentially just spewing out of these broken, basically just fundamentally broken devices. This will be like 1 in 1,000 or even less of these devices are broken, but they can account for over 50% of the leakage. So this is a really big issue. It represents a couple things. In one sense, it's a real challenge. So you've got an industry with 500,000 wells, millions of miles of pipe, lots of compressors. How do you find the 1 in 1,000 that's broken? So that's a real challenge. On the other hand, what it shows is that if you can find these guys cheaply and fix them, you can actually solve something like, we think, half the leakage by just fixing a really small number of devices. Very profitable. If you can get the company to find these cheaply, they'll make a lot of money fixing these. And so this is one of the things we're working on in a phase two project, is to develop technology to find these leaks rapidly, cheaply, greatly reduce the cost of finding them so that it makes sense for the companies to go out and fix them right away.
So that's a win-win situation. The company will save some money. The environment will save some methane leaked out. Now, to be honest, I didn't understand what the study found out about certain regions with high levels of methane versus the national picture. Where are those high emission areas, and what did you conclude about them?
Yeah, so this is interesting. There's been a number of studies, largely airplane-based studies, in natural gas-producing regions that have come out over the last year. So there was a study in Colorado, and there was a study in Utah in particular that found very high leakage rates from the production system, between 4 and 9% in their central estimates. To give you a sense, a 9% leakage rate is well above that at which it makes sense to burn coal instead of natural gas. This is a very significant leakage rate, and that was found in Utah. What we find is that when you take those results and say, okay, we've observed leakage in Colorado, we've observed leakage in Utah, very high leakage rates, if you scale that out to the whole industry, it just doesn't make sense. So there's been a variety of studies that have flown over the entire country. So instead of focusing on a given region, they'll fly airplanes and take measurements from towers across the entire country. They find a certain excess amount of excess methane in the atmosphere. What you find is these national scale studies, they find a lot of excess methane, but they don't find that much excess methane. And so what we think is that these regional studies that are finding very high leakage rates out of, let's say, Utah, that just can't be the case nationally, because otherwise these very detailed studies, often across the whole country, they use thousands and thousands of measurements, would be finding more methane over basically the entire U.S. than we currently observe. And so we think that these highest level studies can essentially put a cap on how much methane is possibly being emitted from the gas industry. And we think these cases that have been observed from the airplanes are likely outliers because they don't line up with the largest scale studies.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock with our guest, Dr. Adam Brandt from Stanford University. He's the lead author of a new paper titled Methane Leaks from the North American Natural Gas Systems. Well, now, both the EPA and the industry have been publishing data about the amounts of methane escaping. How do your new figures compare to what was previously said about it?
Yeah, so our new figure for methane emissions overall is about 1.5 times what EPA is estimating emissions are. And so we think there's about 50% excess methane, and that's our central estimate. We were not able to come to consensus about a number for the natural gas industry. We actually think, and that so for methane overall, we think the best estimate from these very large-scale studies is this factor of 1.5. So we have 50% excess methane. We weren't able to come up with a natural gas industry-specific number. We actually think that the evidence is sufficiently mixed and just sort of confusing at this point, honestly, that we think that it's premature to draw an estimate for how much of this excess is being contributed from the natural gas industry. The numbers are kind of all over the map, and we just need more science to understand what the gas industry is contributing to this overall excess.
Yes, that's something I think we'd all like to know. What percentage of overall methane emissions in the United States from all sources comes from the natural gas system? But I'm gathering that we just don't know that.
No, we don't know that. I mean, we know that there's lots of evidence from gas-specific studies in a region in Texas or Colorado or Utah that show that emissions are likely higher than EPA says. But we can't go from those and really say, okay, nationally, this is the contribution. We know that other sources are contributing as well. There's cows, emissions from cows and manure. There's emissions from landfills. So we think there's other things contributing as well, that this isn't just a natural gas problem, but we can't say other than that how much the gas industry is contributing, which we would like to have said, but we just couldn't come to scientific agreement on that.
And when we look at the whole system, do we also count what happens when these pipelines blow up, as one just did in Kentucky? They can burn for days. That's a lot of carbon right there. Should we add that to the climate risk of using natural gas?
Ideally, you would. Thankfully, those types of events tend to actually be pretty rare. We had a recent explosion, very unfortunate, in California as well, where some homes and lives were lost. Thankfully, those don't happen very much, so they're not likely to be contributing a huge amount. But yes, ideally, you would make an estimate for that sort of loss and add that as well.
So, Adam Brandt, we know any methane going into the atmosphere is a bad idea, especially given the carbon dioxide we're already pumping up there. Still, your team concluded that natural gas is better than coal in some applications. Please tell us about that.
Yeah, sure. So when you look at climate warming potential over a 100-year time scale, which is the more typical or more commonly used timescale to assess climate impacts. What you find is that if the gas system is leaking less than something around 7% of the gas, then it's better to replace our coal-fired power plants with natural gas power plants. Even given the fact that we believe that there's an underestimate from the EPA numbers, we don't think the underestimate is that significant. We think it's likely still better to use natural gas than coal. On a 20-year basis, and this is another way to assess the impacts, you require much less leakage in order to have benefit from using gas instead of coal. And this is because methane has a short lifetime in the atmosphere. It has lots of impact up front, and then it decays away and has less impact over time.
Well, you know, I've seen people react both ways to your study. People who are against gas are saying, well, look, they underestimated it. It's terrible. And people who are for gas are saying, well, you know, it's better than coal. This is what they found. So it goes both ways, your study.
Yeah, this is one of the things we noticed. It's sort of it's almost a test. Depending on what opinion you came in about the gas industry with, you can find evidence to support your cause. So we think it's worse than EPA says, the leakage problem, but likely not as bad as the most extreme estimates. And so we somewhat come down in the middle. So some people view the study positively and some people view the study negatively with respect to the emissions problem. So perhaps that means we're doing something right. I'm not sure.
And another thing in your study that surprised a few folks, maybe even the president himself, was when you found switching trucks from diesel fuel to natural gas may not help the climate. Can you talk about that, please?
Yeah. So diesel trucks and diesel buses are quite efficient. Diesel engines are already more efficient than gasoline engines, and they burn quite efficiently. They use the energy quite efficiently. For that reason, you need a pretty stringent requirement. You need a pretty tight gas system without a lot of leaks in order to have gas make sense over diesel. So what the study we used calculated for a leakage percentage at which you would be better off to stay with diesel and not switch to gas was 1.7%. So at 1.7% or above, you should stick with a diesel truck. What we found is that EPA's current estimate is about 1.5%, and so it's really already very close to this cutoff. And we think because of the evidence for excess emissions from the natural gas industry, we're likely above this 1.7% cutoff. And this says that from a climate perspective, we shouldn't switch from diesel trucks to gas trucks or diesel buses to gas buses. Now, there's a lot of good reasons, other reasons, to switch from diesel. I don't really want to ride on a diesel bus. I don't really like to stand next to a diesel bus that's idling or a school bus. They're stinky. You know, there's local air quality concerns. We may be concerned about oil imports and dependence on the Middle East or other issues associated with oil use. So there's likely to be a variety of good reasons to use natural gas buses or natural gas trucks. But from a climate perspective, it doesn't look to be a winner.
Now, you've touched on this already, but I'm wondering if you can expand on it, on ways that you could suggest we reduce this amount of methane leaking out of our natural gas systems.
So a lot of people are working on this around the country. Major funding on this from governments, universities, national labs, companies, tons of people are working on this. There's a variety of approaches. So some people are working on very cheap sensors. They'll be like a smoke alarm almost in your house, and you'll station these around natural gas facilities, and they'll essentially set off an alarm when they sniff excess methane. So that's one approach. Another approach is to use remote sensing, such as via aircraft or satellites, to essentially hunt down these leaks using cameras or other sensing technologies, and then essentially alert an operator when a well is leaking. Our technology that we're going to be working on in our second phase study is an airplane-based remote sensing type technology. But there's a lot of ideas out there about how to do this. And really the challenge is you need to do this cheaply and without a lot of labor. Labor is expensive in the oil and gas industry, and this is a big infrastructure with miles and miles of pipe and wells scattered across the landscape. And so once you get guys driving around in trucks, this gets expensive, and this is why these leaks continue. So we need to find a way to make this very cheap to scan these facilities frequently and find the leaks. And so that's what a lot of people are working on. And I'm confident that we can find solutions that will bring the cost of finding these leaks down by a lot. I think it can get a lot cheaper with modern technology.
And what about better regulation, just requiring people, you can't vent it into the atmosphere. You have to capture it. You have to use it, things like that.
Yeah, so EPA is moving on that. So starting in 2015, it's not going to be allowed any longer to vent the emissions associated with hydraulic fracturing, which will be a big step in the right direction, and a lot of companies are already moving in that direction. In addition, Colorado just a few days ago introduced new regulations that require operators to once a month scan their facilities, find the leaks, and fix them. This is a big step forward, we think, towards solving the problem. And so to the extent that more states or the whole country can move in that direction, then we think there's going to be benefit. And to the extent that we can invent technology to make this very cheap, it'll become a win-win situation.
It's been great talking with you. The latest report on this problem is found in the paper Methane Leaks from the North American Natural Gas Systems. It was published in the February 14th edition of the journal Science. Find the links you need in my show blog at ecoshock.info. We've been talking with the lead author from the Department of Energy Resources Engineering at Stanford University, Dr. Adam R. Brandt. Thank you so much for telling us about your work.
Thank you.
Radio EcoShock.
Next up, two guests explain a new warning from the top body for American scientists. Scientists know we are heading over a climate cliff, something not seen in human times on Earth. Why are they not speaking out? Well, they are. The American Association for the Advancement of Science is launching a new report called What We Know. To talk about it, I've reached Dr. James McCarthy, Alexander Agassiz Professor of Biological Oceanography at Harvard University. Dr. McCarthy, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you, Alex.
Well, the key question is, why is the AAAS speaking out now?
The AAAS is speaking out now because we believe that the message that climate scientists have been putting together over the last few decades and attempting to convey more and more succinctly is not getting through. And it's perhaps for several reasons, but the AAAS, with its broad authority, it's our largest general scientific organization, has a powerful voice for science in this country, publishes the preeminent science journal by the name Science, the weekly journal, decided that it's time to try and put together a message that would be clearly stating what climate scientists from many, many different perspectives have been saying through their sort of individual communication media over the last few decades.
Well, I've had some very worried scientists on Radio EcoShock. They say we're on a pathway towards a 4°C global change or more. What is in the new association report?
The new association report would confirm that finding, confirm that projection that has come now from a range of studies over the last several years. But it goes further. It, first of all, makes it clear that this is not something that just a small group of scientists in one particular study have found, but makes it clear that between 95 and 100%, we say more than 97% of climate scientists agree that the climate is changing, that humans are a major contributor to this, and importantly, if we ignore these findings, there could be some very damaging outcomes, and we do talk about those.
Yeah, you know, I see some pretty frightening stories every day coming from scientists, and I worry that we don't have an international body that is gathering that in real time. Yes, we have the IPCC, but they come out every 5 or 6 years, and science is moving so quickly. Do you have any suggestions on how we could bring this all together?
The IPCC is sort of by design a very slow and cumbersome process. It's impossible to do a report as exhaustive as they attempt more often than about every 5 or 7 years. It's just too much material to assimilate. It takes too much time. And most people who haven't been involved in this effort don't realize that the scientists who engage in that are all volunteers. You know, we do that between midnight, 2 in the morning, and Saturday afternoon. There's no group of people who are employed to do the work the scientists do in this effort. So we do need, I agree with you, a more nimble process. We're seeing some of that now. We're seeing it arising. I think this effort in AAAS is is one in which we're hoping that a group of scientists from the perspective I just mentioned coming together with a statement will have an effect. We know that within the United States, there are groups that are putting together something called our national assessment, and this will be helpful. But you're right, the reminder every 5 or 7 years with a lot of press, the IPCC reports come out, is not frequent enough.
Can you give us just a couple of points from the AAAS report, what we know?
Well, as I said earlier, we attempt to make it clear that there is no debate among climate scientists. You will find people, some with scientific credentials, who will say they don't accept climate science, but they're not climate scientists. And I think it's very important that when we as individuals who are not scientists or don't know a particular field of science want to know what those scientists feel, that we go to bodies that have the authority to speak across a good swath of that scientific community. So, for example, if we really want to know what would be the most current information on a particular health risk, there are bodies that we would know to go to. If it were a risk relating to cancer, we would go to the American Cancer Society. We would look at a source that has authority in this area. So what we're really hoping is that people who have not paid close attention before or might have been confused by statements by people who are not climate scientists saying, not to worry, nothing's happening, that those people are like those who maybe 20 years ago would say the same about smoking. So by having the AAAS, the American Association for the Advancement of Science, come out with a statement like this, we hope it will then be clearly stated and have authority. We go on to say that if we ignore this information, if we do not pay attention to what the climate science is telling us, there are a number of ways in which changes that are now beginning to happen could become sufficiently worse to create massive disruption. And that massive disruption would displace people. It would be very costly in terms of not only the lives and well-being of people, but also property, infrastructure. You need only think of sea level rise to immediately know what we're talking about here, and we give some examples of that. And also, we make the point that all the economic analyses show that if we act now, it will be less costly than waiting and gambling that some of these large, massively disruptive events won't happen. That even the gradual change, even if sea level rises as is forecast by the IPCC and other groups, maybe something close to 3 feet this century, that would be enormously costly. Anything we can do to slow that down is cost effective. And if those reports are conservative, and there are reasons to be concerned, they might be too conservative, if sea level rise is greater than that, if it went beyond a meter, one beyond 3 feet, then we get into that territory that we would call massively disruptive. Just think of all the coastal cities, all the coastal infrastructure that would be impacted by a sea level rise of something that would go 3 feet or beyond 3 feet, maybe 6 feet.
It's great that the AAAS is speaking out about this at this time. It's really needed. We've been talking with Dr. James McCarthy. He's a professor of biological oceanography at Harvard University. He's also an advisor for the new effort by the American Association for the Advancement of Science to wake us all up to the growing threat of climate change. You can find a link to their new report, What We Know, in my show blog at ecoshock.info or at the AAAS website. Thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you, Alex, and thanks for suggesting people go to the website. You'll find a lot more information there.
Right, you are. I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. You are tuned to Radio EcoShock, now broadcast by over 60 college and community radio stations in the United States, Canada, Britain, and Australia. I'm Alex Smith saying, as we head into a crisis of energy, economy, and the environment, we need alternative voices more than ever. Please support your local nonprofit station. I seldom get the chance to interview Wall Street players about climate change and industry responsibility, so this release by the AAAS was a good chance to do just that. Bob Litterman is a former partner and risk manager at Goldman Sachs. With other Goldman alumni, he's now with fund manager Kapos Capital. Bob, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you. Yeah, I'm glad to be here.
Well, just last week we ran audio from Mark Chapman of CarbonTracker.org. He's been warning international stock markets are at a high risk due to unburnable reserves on the books of the world's biggest energy companies. What is your take on that?
Well, we like to think about companies that are sensitive to emissions being priced as what we call stranded assets. And clearly there are some companies whose valuations will be sensitive to emissions being priced, things like coal and tar sands. So there's definitely some risk out there in the stock market. And, of course, there's other companies whose prospects may be improved by emissions being priced.
So Chapman says disinvestment in fossil fuel corporations is important, but a more realistic plan would be to stop that expensive exploration for more stranded assets and just return those current profits to the shareholders. And that would maybe allow an orderly winding down of sunset companies like ExxonMobil and BP. Your thoughts?
Oh, well, you know, I think there's a lot of uncertainty about when and where emissions are going to be priced, and there's a lot of uncertainty about which companies will benefit or not. And so, look, I would try and avoid using too broad a brush here. It's hard to say whether a particular company, say ExxonMobil, is going to do better or not when emissions are priced. It depends on their mix of fossil fuels. You know, natural gas reserves, for example, may become more valuable when emissions are priced. But I think it's probably fair to say that coal reserves and tar sands are probably going to be negatively impacted, but I don't want to speculate too much about individual companies.
You know, scientists warn we're on a pathway to more than 4 degrees centigrade warming this century alone, and to be frank, Bob, most of us have given up on any political process to negotiate reductions in emissions internationally, and a lot of people feel the real power is on Wall Street. Could an awakening of fund managers and billionaires help save us?
Oh, I think absolutely. First of all, I think there is a lot of recognition of the problem now. Very few people that have thought about it seriously are not concerned. And so I'm actually quite hopeful and optimistic that something's going to be done. And economists know that what needs to be done is to create appropriate incentives for economic agents to conserve on their production of fossil fuels. And economic agents meaning everyone, consumers, producers, investors, entrepreneurs. And, you know, how that happens and plays out is very uncertain, and when it plays out. The other issue is how much of that is already embedded in prices. Now, I would say I don't think much of it is embedded in prices. I think you accurately characterize that most people have very low expectations for an international deal. But there's a lot of things going on. There are a lot of jurisdictions that are pricing emissions, others that are considering that. And when and how a political deal takes place, and whether that's sooner than people expect, is certainly a possibility.
But I can't see just waiting for politicians to bring on a price. I mean, I can't understand how Wall Street companies think they can exist in the long run if sea level rise floods major cities like New York, as happened during Hurricane Sandy. They're saying it could knock out civilization as we know it. How can they come to grips with that?
Well, there's a lot of risks out there. Sea level is one of the impacts that's well understood at this point, and it will rise slowly, you know, over the next several decades. Really, no matter what we do at this point, a lot of impacts are baked into the cake. And, you know, society will have to deal with those things, adapt to them. I think the bigger risk is unexpected impacts, you know, positive feedbacks, potentially unexpected impacts that may lead to tipping points, some set of unforeseen circumstances. So that's the risk. And I think it's really those unknown risks that are most important to deal with in terms of reducing the emissions starting immediately. And the way to do that at scale and most powerfully, obviously, is to institute appropriate incentives. The economists call those incentives the social cost of carbon. Those are the externalities that are created by emissions, the damages that are expected, as well as the unknown risks that are created by those emissions. And economists estimate, you know, that those incentives ought to be in the range of, oh, anywhere from the U.S. government says $37 a ton, although that's much too precise. It really is very uncertain. The Stern report a few years ago from the U.K. estimated maybe on the order of $85 a ton. So there's a wide range. No one really thinks the appropriate price is zero. And in fact, if you look at the incentives globally, they're quite strong incentives to consume fossil fuels, creating emissions. In fact, the International Energy Agency estimates those subsidies to be on the order of $500 billion a year, which is to say something on the order of $15 a ton of incentives to create emissions. So we really have to turn that completely around and create appropriate incentives to conserve on emissions. And that's how we can address this problem. If it looks like, you know, there's a lot of uncertainty about how bad things might be, and that will affect the price going forward. So if things do seem to be worse than anticipated, it may be that in the future we're going to have to start sucking carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere. And that could be a very expensive proposition. And so it's much cheaper to do the things we can do now to stop putting it into the atmosphere rather than forcing those who live 20, 30 years into the future worrying about pulling it out. At which point a lot of the damages would be much greater than they are today.
Is there any real pipeline for conversation between what scientists know and Wall Street players?
Well, you know, Wall Street players are betting on, if you will, or making assumptions about emissions pricing. And, you know, I was just at a conference today where the Carbon Disclosure Project is working with both Wall Street investors as well as corporations to talk about what prices they're expecting and what they're doing to change their mix of capital and other things to deal with emissions being priced. I think it's very much going to happen. It's just a question of when. And, you know, there's not much that can be done by individuals or corporations, investors, or Wall Street until governments institute appropriate incentives. You know, this is something that really has to be addressed fundamentally by governments. Of course, if you're a utility making a decision about how to generate power for the next 30 or 40 years, you're going to decide whether or not to build a coal-fired plant or something else based on what you expect those incentives to be over that period of time. And so expectations here are really critical, but those expectations ultimately are tied to the ability to get governments to act.
So what would you advise your clients about climate risk? What should they do?
Well, you know, I'm on the board of the World Wildlife Fund, and we did something very innovative that I think makes a lot of sense for investors. We entered into a stranded assets total return swap. We didn't touch our underlying portfolio, and what we did do is we decided to, in a derivative structure, sell the returns of two indices, one of coal and another one of tar sands, and receive the total return on the S&P. So what that essentially does is it hedges stranded assets that are in the portfolio, and you could also think of it as taking advantage of an opportunity. You can today sell stranded assets at current valuations, which are, you know, building in a very low probability of emissions being priced. And if emissions are priced, you stand to benefit. So it's a way of taking advantage of that opportunity of irrational pricing in the marketplace.
Well, I'm hoping for just one more level of action where the people who are involved in banks or whatever look at their kids and say, gee, we can't fund this coal plant. Even if there are no prices for emissions, we just can't do it. Is that possible?
Well, if you expect emissions to be priced in the future, you wouldn't build that coal plant. So what you can do, even without pricing of emissions, is build expectations that they will be priced. And building those expectations is really a matter of electing public officials that are rational.
I agree. Well, thank you so much for talking with us. This is Radio EcoShock. Our guest has been Bob Litterman, a risk assessment expert with Keppos Capital in New York. Thank you again.
I trust you heard the World Wildlife Fund has investments in both coal and the tar sands. Fearing a possible price on carbon, they didn't sell those investments. Instead, the WWF kind of greenwashed the situation by using a derivative swap to be able to say the income was from a general stock index instead. I'm sure the wildlife heading for extinction would understand. None of us can afford to wait for a price on carbon. Pension funds, universities, nonprofits, and anyone with a brain needs to get out of fossil fuels right now. They are killing off our future. Congratulations to the American Association for the Advancement of Science for having the guts to speak out against climate change and denial. Now to a topic I've followed for years, the threat to world food production from an unstable climate. We're already seeing it, and the future has worse to come. We've all got that sinking feeling climate change could mean food shortages in coming decades, but we really don't know how or how much. An international team of scientists has plowed through vast numbers of studies trying to add up what we know. They've published a first look at their findings in the journal Nature Climate Change. At the University of Leeds, where he teaches climate impacts, we've reached the lead author, Dr. A.J. Challenor. Andy Challenor, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thanks very much.
Well, I'd like to begin with a couple of broad assumptions that we've come to accept about the future of food in this warming world. The first is a huge generality, and before we get to the detailed results of your study, can we say that climate change will probably reduce future food production?
I think that climate change will have effects that are different in different places, and climate change will have an effect on the year-to-year variability of production. But taken on average, with an aggregate look at what we expect for agriculture, including the fact that we know that some regions will benefit, we can say that actually most regions are going to have to adapt if we're going to keep yields high.
Good. Now, food experts, including Lester Brown of the Earth Policy Institute, have used a maxim for every degree of warming, world food production would be reduced by 10%. Well, now we've really studied it. Does that hold up in your meta-analysis?
Yeah, I think this is exactly the issue I was just talking about, where we're taking average yield and saying what's going to happen on average across the whole globe. You know, there's so many different agricultural systems that we're averaging across, and there are a number of different figures that you can come up with. This particular study, we didn't produce a kind of central figure for a percent reduction per year, but, you know, we certainly showed that we can expect 5 to 10% drop in the 2030s, maybe a bit more, in fact, than that in some places and times. And then later in the century, decreases of more than 25% will become increasingly common. So that's more or less, I think, consistent with the figure you just cited.
So how does your new paper compare to the previous AR4 report of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change? And will it be part of the new fifth assessment report coming out this year?
Yeah, so the fifth assessment report, as you may know, comes out in a week or two. And I'm one of the authors on that study, so this study certainly feeds directly into that. I can't really comment on the study, on the IPCC assessment itself, but at the moment. But in terms of the differences between our study that's just been published and AR4, for example, in AR4 it was shown or believed that from the model results that 1 or 2 degrees of warming in temperate regions would be something that, you know, more or less would be able, we would, our agricultural systems would be able to cope with, and in fact that yields may even go up a little bit. What we found is that on average that's not true. And again, that phrase on average is important, but still, on average yields are more likely to go down for a degree or two of warming than to go up.
So before we get to conclusions, there are serious reservations about gaping holes in our data and our methods of collection. And this isn't a criticism of your work. Your team raised these problems over and over again in this latest letter in the journal Nature Climate Change. And I want to just take one example. Previous crop predictions, including those used in your summary analysis, assume there will be enough water for crops in the coming decades and after 2050, but California's already in a drought, and major wheat areas in Russia and Australia were hit by drought in the last 5 years. India and China may be approaching limits to what they can pump out of the ground. Can we really assume there will be the water we need in this future hotter world?
Yeah, so that assumption about water is very important. It applies, of course, to irrigation. There are rain-fed crops, and obviously the simulations take account of the changes in rainfall that we expect with climate change. So really, there's no big issue there to do with water availability or not taking account of water availability. However, when people conduct simulations that say, okay, what happens with irrigation, that's where people make that assumption. Well, quite naturally, it's a necessary assumption to conduct the modeling, is to say, well, if we had sufficient water for irrigation, what would the yields be? And you know, one of the future challenges for this area of research that I think we're starting to see in the literature, we're starting to see scientists do, is to look at that water availability using the information that we have about future water and rainfall, and say, well, is that water going to be available for irrigation? And if it isn't, then the OZ irrigation simulations need to say, well, we'd like to add more water than this, but we can't because the water simply isn't, you know, we don't think the water will be available. So, you know, I think that's an area where already we're seeing the science improving, but it's definitely something that at the moment we recognize where there are simulations to do with irrigation that, you know, it does make that assumption, and that may not necessarily hold, as you say, in particular regions, California being an example.
And then we have the problems in the micro world. Do we really know how pests and plant diseases might change in the warming decades ahead?
That, again, that's something that's emerging, but very difficult to do comprehensively, to say every pest that might affect every crop, every disease that might affect every crop, and how it will change, how that pathogen, for example, will change under climate change, and then saying, well, how will that match up and how will that impact on crop yield? So, you know, that's a very big area, really, for understanding. There are lots of people working on that for particular crops, for particular locations, but synthesizing an overall summary in the way that we have in our paper, an overall summary that includes pests and diseases, is very difficult simply because of the sheer number of different pests and diseases that exist and the interactions that they have with the crops.
And Andy, you've raised the problem of assuming a mean pattern of growth versus possible weather extremes, as we're already seeing in North America and the UK and elsewhere. Could you talk to us about that? Why is that important?
Yeah, I mean, it's very important. So it's something that we're seeing in the US and in the UK, as you say. It's something that is beginning to be attributed to climate change. That's not something we tackle in our paper, but that's a sort of comment on the broader literature. What we do in the paper is look at what we expect in the future with regard to year-to-year variability. And what we see is that drought and heat stress do mean, and sort of the irregular pattern of drought and heat stress do mean that the year-to-year variability in crop yield will increase. And we've already seen where there are years of low production because of heat stress events, say in Russia, we've seen this with wheat, and also in Australia. There have been subsequent food price rises that aren't necessarily related one-to-one with those production decreases, but nonetheless, there's an interaction and a relationship there. So there could be implications there for food prices, and certainly, you know, stability of our food production is very important. We need to know that there will be enough food in any given year. So that year-to-year variability really is a key issue.
Despite these variables, your team did manage to assess what we know about our human future in agriculture, and it seems to depend on where we live. Why don't we start with the three biggest food crops in the temperate zones, where most of my listeners are? What can we predict so far?
So, on average, as I say, for let's start with wheat. Then for temperate regions, as I say, even 1 to 2 degrees of warming, and certainly more than that, will reduce yields on average. But of course, you know, there will be within that, there's a range, and that range includes increases. So, you know, there will be regions where yields will increase. And, you know, there's a similar pattern for maize or corn, where maybe less clear that there will be increases in yield with maize than is the case for wheat. But again, the challenge there becomes taking advantage of adapting to where there are challenges, but also taking advantage of that potential for increases in yield.
And it seems like every chart shows a decline of food production in the tropics, where billions of people live. Why is that?
Yeah, so tropical regions already are essentially growing crops at higher temperatures than we are in temperate regions. They're very dependent on rain-fed agriculture. They're dependent on monsoon systems, so disruptions to that cause problems. So it's a combination of those things, really. Being already at temperatures that are quite high means that adding more to that begins to cause problems, you know, sooner than it does for temperate regions.
Again, Lester Brown has said that rice is already, at least the varieties we have now, is already pretty close to its peak warming limits, and a 1 or 2 degree rise could have very fundamental effects for people who depend on rice for their diets.
Yeah, absolutely. Rice is a hugely important crop, and again, is another crop that without adaptation, we expect yields to decrease on average in most of rice is in tropical regions, but there were a handful of data for temperate regions that show a similar effect.
You're listening to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with our guest, Dr. Andy Challenor from the University of Leeds. Existing studies of the impact of climate change on agriculture assume we'll make incremental changes to keep food growing. What are some of the adaptations we can expect to see?
So early on, I mean a sort of 1 to 2 degrees of warming or something that can begin to happen already, include a change in crop variety to a variety that might be more tolerant if we're seeing increasing drought, or, you know, perhaps a different crop, or you know, smaller changes like a change in planting date, realizing that maybe warmer temperatures might mean we can plant a little earlier in temperate regions. So those are the kind of small, the relatively small adjustments that the models that we looked at in our paper can do quite a good job of simulating and of taking account of. They're not so good at doing the sort of bigger well, by definition, they don't do the bigger changes associated with how agriculture might look in the future or what kind of investments are needed or what kind of movements of agricultural zones are needed.
As your paper notes, humans may have to change what they grow completely if we get a lot of warming, and millions of farmers depend on traditional knowledge. Some don't have sophisticated communication skills or education. Is it realistic to think we'll be able to make large-scale changes of crops?
I think this is where the issue of planning is important. This is where there's a role for government, for agricultural extension workers, and actually for education as well. And I think those larger changes that are needed, there is time to plan. And I think that's very much a job for governments, maybe non-governmental organizations as well, maybe in temperate regions as well, but maybe particularly in developing countries, to begin to plan and think about that. And the science is now at a point where we can start to deliver those answers of, look, here's when we expect the major changes. It won't be a particular year or perhaps even a particular decade, but, you know, look, by the 2030s to the 2050s, we're seeing these larger changes and we need to start planning for them. So, you know, I'm optimistic about that because I think there is time and we do have the kind of infrastructure and organizations that exist in order to conduct exactly that kind of planning.
And the other end of that stick is people like to eat what they've always eaten. I'm thinking of farmers in Central America who turn to black beans as more climate tolerant than red beans, but they export most of it because local people want to eat red beans with their rice. Can science account for things like cultural bias and tradition?
Well, that would be an input to the models. If I think social science really is the area where we say, okay, let's do some surveys, produce some analysis that tells us about these very important cultural biases or preferences that people have. And then we can put that into the model and say, look, you know, people don't want to be growing this particular crop in this region. They want to be growing this other crop. How will that other crop fare? Is this going to be a sustainable pattern for food production? So I think, you know, that's an area where science, natural science plus social science can really begin to, you know, deliver some of those more nuanced answers that get to people's preferences.
And all of these difficulties take place against the backdrop of a human population growing by hundreds of thousands of people every day. From your study, are we looking at how to keep up with today's level of food production in the future, or are we looking at how to expand agriculture to match that global population of maybe 9, 10, or more billion people?
Very important question. In our study, we are looking at what is going to happen to crop yield as climate changes. And all other things being equal, crop yield is the food that's produced per unit area. It tells you about production. It doesn't tell you anything about demand. So the backdrop to the paper that we don't address within the paper is, well, you know, yes, the paper says we've got decreases in crop yield happening, but actually the situation suggested by an increasing population is worse than that simply suggested by these declines in production, because we're going to need to produce more in the future, not just the same. And within the framework of our paper, we focus really on saying, well, what if we just wanted to keep producing the same? But actually, you know, we do need to produce more in the future. We will do.
And that's even more true if people move up the food chain towards meat. We won't even go there. But what about the counter arguments, such as increased carbon dioxide will be a benefit to the plants, a longer growing season, maybe in temperate climates, and from that, new croplands opening up places further north in Canada or Siberia? Can those benefits overcome the damage caused by warming?
There's a couple of important things in there. In a number of my answers to your questions, I've stressed and I've said, on average, this will happen to crop yield. And it's, those two words are important because you're absolutely right. In some places, in some situations, there will be new opportunities. And making the most of those new opportunities is important. Now, overall, the picture seems to be one of reducing yields and of negative impacts. But that doesn't mean we shouldn't be focusing on those opportunities. And as to the question of CO2, I don't have the number in front of me, but a large number of the studies that we reviewed for this meta-analysis account for the direct effect of CO2 on crops. You know, that didn't used to be so common maybe 10 or so years ago, but it's increasingly common now because, of course, people recognize it's a real effect and we need to include it in the model. So actually, a lot of the results are, you know, in spite of that increase in CO2 and the direct effect of that on crops.
And what about the weather extremes you touched on in this latest paper? Just 2 years of drought can wipe out cattle farmers, or a single year of strange cold at the wrong time can kill off orchards, as can record strong winds. Do you worry about the outlier events as opposed to a slowly changing mean warming?
Yeah, absolutely. This is exactly the point alluded to earlier about increases in variability, the year-to-year variation, drought events, heat stress events. meaning that we have a given year with particularly low crop yield, and we expect that year-to-year variability to increase in the future, and that poses a problem for planning and ensuring a stable food supply.
And we've had scientists recently on Radio EcoShock say problems with food are basic to society as a whole. Lack of it can lead to revolutions, wars, mass migrations, maybe even mass starvation. You must have some thoughts on a personal level of what your science means for the future.
Yeah, on a personal level. I mean, I think when one gets to that kind of question of personal reactions, my experience of talking to colleagues is it comes down to whether people are natural optimists or natural pessimists. And, you know, I stressed the importance of innovation a short while ago, and I think it's very important to take advantage of innovation. We're a very innovative species. So, you know, maybe that's part of where I come at this from. But, you know, really, the science takes you so far, as you say, and then you say, here are the evidence, here are the numbers. And you know, even amongst experts, and certainly it's a general comment about people, that people will interpret things in different ways and have more optimistic or more pessimistic views of that. I certainly think it is very important that we address the issues posed to food security by climate change, but I think that means taking a balance. I think it means being clear about where there are negative effects and planning and doing something about that, and being clear about those occasions where we think there are some benefits that we may be able to take advantage of.
I see this paper as an important step, but still an early step in this field. How do you see agricultural forecasts and climate science developing as the years progress?
I think it would be important for climate models, climate science, to provide more regionally specific information whilst retaining, while improving, in fact, accuracy. I think that's going to be something that's very important. I think we're already seeing this as well. The use of climate forecasts, weather forecasts out to a few months to say, okay, what can we expect this year? And that's very important when you think about this issue of year-to-year variability. We need to know ahead of time, is this going to be one of the good years or one of the bad years or maybe one of the average years? And so, you know, there's a lot to be done there between climate science and agricultural research and crop science to begin to put together forecasting tools to help us predict on those kind of shorter timescales as well.
As we finish up, is there anything else you would like to pass on to our listeners?
No, I don't think so. It's been a pleasure talking to you about the research, and I hope the listeners have found it interesting.
Our guest has been Andy Challenor, Professor of Climate Impacts at the School of Earth and Environment at the University of Leeds in Britain. He's the lead author of the Nature Climate Change letter titled A Meta-Analysis of Crop Yield Under Climate Change and Adaptation. It was published online March 16, 2014. You can find the links you need in my show blog at ecoshock.info. Andy, thank you for sharing this with Radio EcoShock listeners.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
I'm Alex Smith. That concludes another packed show from Radio EcoShock. I'm your reporter, Alex Smith. Please help this program keep going with your financial support at our website, ecoshock.org. And during the spring fundraising drives, I ask you to pledge support for your local nonprofit radio station. These are not easy times, and we need that platform for the uncomfortable truth to get out there without any advertising. Thank you so much for listening, and I hope we'll meet again next week.